We'll call the House Hess Education and Social Services meeting together to order today. It is 2 minutes after 3:00. This is the 15th of March. This is the Ides of March. Members present are Representative Newman, Representative Faircloth, Representative Seaton, and myself, Wilson. And we have our staff. Kelly is our Hess Secretary, Chris is moderator, and Becky, my aide. So without them, we would never be able to do anything. And if you have cell phones out there, I want to remind you to shut them off. And well, we haven't done this so far, but it would be, if you get caught with your cell phone ringing, we might have you provide donuts to the meeting the next time. I'm going to go over in the order of the bills that we're going to have today. So first of all, we're going to do House Bill 159, Stillbirth Certificates, with Rep. Gatto. Then we'll go to House Bill 2, Vocational Education Fund, with Rep. Newman. And then House Bill 140, Medical Assistance Eligibility, with Guerra. So we will go ahead, and that is the order of business. And we will start out. Oh, trying to look in the audience.
They're way in the back.
Oh, they're hiding. Okay. Yes. Back in the back, we have Representative Book and Representative Dole. So the two of you.
Representative Guerra just walked in.
And Representative Garrett's here too. So you're welcome to. I don't know if the rest of them.
I don't have
absent today.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Anyway, you're welcome to come up here and take a seat unless somebody comes and takes it away from you. So let's go ahead and get started, and we will start with House Bill 159. And this will be the second time we've heard this bill. And you went back to the drawing board, and if you would like to state your name and who you're working for, and what the bill originally said, and then we have a committee substitute, and if we can get a motion to have the committee substitute brought in front of us, that would help. And let the record show that Representative Roses just joined us.
Madam Chair, I'd move to bring work draft version C before us for a discussion.
All right. Hearing no objection, we have the House Bill number 151 version C in front of us.
Okay. Sandra Wilson. I work for Representative Carl Gatto. And so the bill is HB 159, which is still birth certificates. The intent of the bill is to provide a birth certificate for parents of stillborn children, just kind of a way to help them grieve the loss, instead of just handing currently, as the law is, all the parents receive is a death certificate. And so we just want to give parents something that shows that their child was born, and so we want to do that. The CS makes two changes to the bill. The two changes are in Section E and Section G. So the first change is that we added the words not proof of live birth will be on the certificate that they're given. And then Section G, we changed it. Before, it talked about giving a delayed certificate, and so we changed it. So basically it says that you can go back and get a certificate if you had a stillborn before this bill takes effect.
Okay, and let the record show that Representative Gardner has joined us. And Representative Roses, you have a question?
I do. Not so much a question as a comment. I appreciate the revision that you brought back. I think that satisfies the concerns that I brought forward the last time we discussed the bill. And with those changes, I will have no problem supporting this. So thank you for taking care of that.
Representative Stoltz, you are joining us today. If you want to come forward, you can. Otherwise, thank you for stopping by and visiting us for a while.
Don't believe that. Andrea Knoll is back there, too.
Yeah, I already know. Any other questions? Any other comments? Representative Faircloth.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we heard heartfelt testimony the last time this bill was before us. speaking specifically to individuals who carry life, and when they go to deliver or find out at some point during a pregnancy that their child is no longer living. This particular bill brought forward by Representative Gatto addresses that. It has been done in other states. We did talk about issues that were of concern to us with trusts and a possible certificate of birth being used in a way that would misrepresent a child statistic or a legacy. Representative Gatto has tried to address both those in the new version that's before us, and I would encourage us to consider passing and moving this along.
Do I have a motion?
Chair.
Representative Faircloth.
I would like to move from committee CS for House Bill 159, working draft 25-LS0647/C with, do we have a fiscal note? The fiscal notes and as amended?
As amended. Okay, with individual recommendations.
With individual recommendations. Thank
okay.
you. I'll get her all out.
Hearing no objection, this bill has passed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Next is House Bill 2, Representative Newman. And I think Representative Newman has chosen to stay where he's at and have one of his staff come forward. So come forward and take your place. And
Representative Wilson, whether you wherever you want me, that's fine.
I'll let if you want to say something, Mr. Newman first, and then Representative Newman, and then let your staff proceed. That would be fine.
Well, Madam Chair, we'll probably let my staff do an opening presentation. If there's any questions beyond that, I'll certainly be available to ask them.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the HES Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to present HB 2, Representative Newman's bill, creating a vocational education account in the general fund.
Can you state your name, please?
My name is Rex Shattuck, and I'm aide to Representative Mark Newman. And basically, HB 2 creates a vocational education account in the general fund, whereby providing the opportunity for businesses in all sectors of the economy to help in creating vocational opportunities for secondary school in enhancing students by giving them some experience or some opportunity to get into vocational trades at the high school level, kind of to fill the pipeline for some of the other opportunities that they have once they get out of school. Really a very simple bill. It allows for appropriations, gifts, bequests, and contributions into a fund, and after that, the Department of Labor, Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development, in consultation with the Commissioner of Education, would help in directing where those funds go to. That's a very simple bill.
Manager. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mark Newman, District 15. And although my staff may think this was somewhat simple, this was 2 years in the making. Many, many hours spent with the past Commissioner of Labor, Greg Rankes, the Commissioners of Revenue, the Commissioners of Education. And I'm proud to support that most of the current commissioners I've talked to all fully support this legislation. And I don't need to probably explain a lot to this group here the importance that applied sciences of learning math and English, reading, writing, and arithmetic, the core subjects in our classrooms, how you can learn that in vocational skills. When you're learning to rebuild an engine, where you have to figure out the horsepower of an engine, where it's pi r squared times L, you're reading motor manuals. When you're building a home, the amount of math that's done by squaring the foundation or adding, subtracting of fractions, and you're reading the latest building materials that are done in homes. Those are all through applied sciences, and the ability to pass the high school qualifying exams has been somewhat difficult in the past years. Our graduation rate is statewide about 60%, but as low as 47.2% with our Alaska Natives and 67.3% among other races. And that's information that was provided to our committee through First Alaskans. And so this really has affected rural Alaska much more than it has statewide Alaska, again, where we have about a 60% average Mat-Su Anchorage in there. Talking with the industry, and by the way, we have had a tremendous amount of support from folks all the way from Dick Catnaugh, the AFL-CIO, electrical unions, Mike Andrews from Job Corps, across the board, Carl Rose, fully support this legislation. And what private industry does, and the unique part about this bill is it allows private industry to put their money into vocational education. Sounds like a pretty simple prospect, but let me tell you, it's not. And again, that's why 2 years in the making into this legislation is making sure that we stay within the realm of our Constitution with restrictions against dedicated funds, and to make sure that we can work within the bounds of No Child Left Behind at the same time to make sure that the high school students get the credits. And the industry wants to help educate our kids. They're more than willing to help put their money into it. They need a vehicle to do that. That's the purpose of House Bill 2. House Bill 2 does four basic things. Creates a vocational education account, because vocational education is in the same category as special needs, and special needs historically at times or there's been a little hesitancy by private industry to put their money into vocational education, because it can get sucked off. You know, one special needs kid can take $100,000 easily, and it's not that it's not needed. But if private industry wants to put their money into vocational education, they want to ensure it gets there. Thus, the vocational education account, it's a check and balance in the system to make sure that that happens. By allowing, on line 10, page 1, gifts, bequests, and contributions. This is a critical part of the bill. That allows for additional funds, again, the funds by private industry to be put into this account. There's people who've done well in the world that would like to help with vocational education. There's industry that does well in the state of Alaska, makes quite a bit of money. By allowing this, and with a certain part of this dedication, now we ensure that those contributions meet the tax code under federal or under a category called defined public benefit. And that defined public benefit ensures that they can get their federal tax deductions, this allowing this bill to be self-sustaining through the years, to have more money from private industry coming in there. Again, it does not affect our general fund budget. It does not affect our funding for education at all. Another part that, a third part of this is including regional attendance education areas, or REAs, REAs as we know them. It was my goal, if we're going to have a vocational education system, it has to hit every kid in the state. And that's been a very difficult situation to do. And in this program, on page 1 here, line 1, page 2, it says programs and courses approved by the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development in consultation with Commissioner of Education and Department of Education. With that, and when I talked to Commissioner Sampson on this, and my intent on this, and with full regard to an agreement with Commissioner Sampson, when I talked to the Commissioner, I said, Roger, I'd like you to contact 53 school districts around the state and have the school districts identify the vocational needs within each of the schools that they have in their district. This knowledge is a tremendous tool for private industry, who currently spends tens of millions of dollars in the state on PR work. What we will do with this map now, what this will do is create a map regionally around the full state of Alaska of the vocational needs of each school within the state. And there's a tremendous amount of development going on around the state, just about every corner that we have. And as one example is in McGrath, where they, and I don't know how many people have been able to visit their school, But they have a nice metal shop out there, no instructor, sitting there empty. And again, I think it's a complication that we've seen from No Child Left Behind, particularly in rural Alaska, where a lot of the teachers are green. They have a lot of turnover. They don't have the highly qualified status in more than, in several core subjects. Again, reading, writing, and arithmetic. So they don't have a master's. That's saying they don't have a master's degree in each of those or two or three subjects. So they can only teach one of those. The math teacher can't teach English. And so they have to have separate teachers for each one of them. The shop teacher is the first guy to go. And again, going back to rural Alaska, they get more of the green teachers, the new teachers that are starting out that don't have two bachelor's degrees. They don't have a bachelor's degree with this, or and a certificate that says they're qualified in other areas to teach. And if they, the teachers that do have that qualification generally get bought up by the larger school districts because they can pay more. So this has been very detrimental to rural Alaska. Going back to the school in McGrath with their metal shop, now Northern Dynasty, or and this can happen in anywhere in the state, this just happens to be in that specific area, they can go right to the city of McGrath, their city council, their school board, and say, we're going to pay for that welding instructor that you've got. We're going to pay for that so that your kids can go to work in your own backyard. And I think that that's a key part of what this does, again, is creating that regional map around the state so that industry can go to those different needs all around the state to see what's going on. And they're going to be, I think it's going to have a tremendous impact on our schools in rural Alaska when it happens. Again, by putting the ball in the Department of Labor's lap first, Department of Labor is the only entity in the state of Alaska that has a connection with every business in the state of Alaska, at the very least through their business license. But with labor, DOL being, you know, kind of driving the ball here on this first part, they're going to be able to contact industry around the state, let them know what those needs are. Talk to the commissioner, you know, talk to Commissioner Noddy on this for a while, and Commissioner Designee, I should say. And they have a distance delivery vocational program that they're just setting up at the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And when I asked Commissioner Noddy, Commissioner, who do you have at the other end? And he says, do you have somebody there? And he says, well, not really. And do you have the funds? No, we don't. This would provide the funds for that through this account. Another way to make sure we reach every kid in Alaska. Also, maybe Mr. Smith and Igagak or Noatak, any of the rural villages, any, particularly anywhere in the state, it could happen right here in Juneau. But maybe Mr. Smith is willing to teach 10 kids how to weld or fix a furnace or build a home or repair a car. And is willing to teach 10 kids out of that school how to do that, or aid, whatever the case may be. Department of Labor can say, okay, Mr. Smith does have the qualifications. He's got 20 years of practical experience. He's got state certification in welding. Yes, he does meet the qualified status that we have to have. Working with the Department of Education, and again, in consultation, my consultation, talking with Commissioner Sampson, again, talking with Commissioner Bishop on this issue also, with the Department of Labor and Education. What I'd like to see is Mr. Sampson help the school districts set up a grade appropriate level. Now, our state of Alaska is set up with grade standards that we have now, where they say in 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, this is the level of math that you should have, this level of English, this is what you should have in those core subjects. So if the commissioner of DED can help Mr. Smith set up a program so that those kids, when they're learning welding, they're getting the right math by learning different amperages and voltages and watts and how those are transferable through resistive energies into the welding circuits. They're reading different materials on that to make sure that they meet the grade appropriate levels in the core subjects. Now we're able to make sure we're getting a vocational program to every kid in the state. And it's paid for by private industry. The money from this would come out of private industry. And it's critical that we start reaching every kid in the state. It's critical that we start getting the vocational programs back into the schools. And I can speak to this personally because it affects my life. You know, I live it. I design and build custom fine furniture. I'm a woodworker today. I supported my family professionally as a mechanic, built a home, raised kids. When I was a mechanic, I'm a woodworker today. And it goes right back to what I learned in vocational education because I had that opportunity to have that touch my life, to have that exposure. The unions, they're more popular or are known for their apprenticeship programs, although a lot of private industry also has apprenticeship programs. Absolutely love the idea of this program like this, again, to allow more vocational programs back into the schools. They spend a tremendous amount of money on apprenticeship programs, but there's a certain percentage of that, 10, 15, to up to 30%, I've heard from some of them, where those folks that come into their apprenticeship programs drop out because it's just not their bag. Getting that exposure at the high school level is critical. It's going to do several things. It's going to expand the number of students who want to go into those programs because they might say, hey, I like welding. I could do this for a living. I like being a mechanic. I could do this for a living. Or they're not going to enter into a program that they're not familiar with and they just say this is not what they're doing. Now, that industry is going to save money by having an applicant in there who wants that job instead of somebody who loses, doesn't want that job. They just lost that position and the money that they put into it. That's more money that can go back into this program. Talking to Doug Ward at Ketchikan Dry Dock, he said, this would be a tremendous tool for him. And just about everybody in history, wants to get in there and help. Again, this, I could go on and on about the many things that this has to offer. And again, when you look at line 6, page 2, it also includes secondary and post-secondary levels of education that are available for this. Again, Madam Chair, just to wrap this up and put it together, this bill does four major things. It allows for a vocational education account to give the assurances to industry that their money will go to vocational education. It allows for gifts, bequests, and contributions so that folks, maybe private individuals, can put money into this program or industry. I've talked to businesses that are willing to put up hundreds of thousands of dollars to put into this program. I'm sure we've all talked to them. It allows it to hit every kid in the state of Alaska. And it allows for secondary and post-secondary level. And again, working with the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development in consultation with DED. You might notice that the verbiage in this is somewhat short. There's a reason for that. I didn't want to tie the hands of the folks who work within Department of Labor and Department of Education on the material that would go into here, through different resolutions. And I'm a woodworker again. Trying to come up with this idea to make sure we stay within the confines of NCLB, to make sure that we meet our constitutional regulations with restrictions against dedicated funds. 2 years in the making on this, many, many hours. Again, not trying to tie the hands of the commissioners. They're the experts on implementation of the very fine specifics on this, and I wanted to leave it up to those experts. So I'm glad to answer any questions.
Representative Newman, what do you perceive if BP wants to give this certain school over here money? How do they do that? Do they write it out a check to the school? What do they do?
Well, Chair Wilson, currently they can do that right now. But by having a vocational education account that has the ability to accept gifts, bequests, contributions, it helps ensure that they're going to get that federal deduction, that they can get it up there at the federal level. That's very important to make sure we have a new renewable program, but they can currently do that at any program now.
Representative Faircloth.
Representative Newman has another bill that is running right now, and so I think there's a little bit more to the answer. There's a corporate income tax credit bill that is running on a separate track. And so while they might be allowed to take it at a federal level, they haven't been able to donate in the past to a secondary level. And Representative Newman has another bill that he could speak to that wouldn't be appropriate here to speak to, but it is running a track, so there would be an additional benefit. But this, just for the committee, stands by itself alone as a way to set up a vocational account. And he's working, from my perspective, in a very positive way on another track that would provide an incentive to provide funds for this account that are from private sector versus the state of Alaska.
Madam Chair.
Representative Newman.
If I could address that, Madam Chair, Representative Fairclough. With this type of an account, it would allow the governor to more easily direct any other funds that they may be available to the Department of Revenue to vocational education and add additional funds.
Follow-up, Representative.
I just wanted to state for the record, certainly the municipality of Anchorage has been successful as a government agency partnering with private foundations or corporations to allow them the opportunity to contribute directly to the municipality, is my experience. And I know that ConocoPhillips in the past has supported Westchester Lagoon and skating in the park and different things. And so it seems to me that this fund would be set up somewhat along those lines and allowing corporate partnerships if the state of Alaska chose to engage in those partnerships.
Okay, Representative Zeke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, and of course I agree with the concept here. I'm just talking about the details. And it seems that the structure of the bill is such that money will go into almost like the general fund, and then the commissioners are going to decide where it goes. It's not the school partners. I don't see anything in here that allows Donlin Creek to partner with a certain village to get schools. If we're talking about doing statewide studies and getting vocational education money to everybody, I'm just trying to get the structure of this is whether, okay, it comes into here and now the Commissioner of Education looks at it and doles out $500 to every school. I'm trying to understand. I know where you're coming from, Representative Newman, and I fully agree with it. But I'm trying to understand how that is contained in the structure.
And Representative Newman, I'm going to give you some leeway that we're not supposed to give in a committee too much about another bill, but just sum up in a couple sentences what the other bill does so that the committee can understand that there's a parallel bill running along that will fold into this to make things work out.
Madam Chair, actually they won't fold into it each other, but they can work side by side.
Okay.
As Carl Rose likes to say, they're going to surf together. First off, Madam Chair, if I may respond to Representative Seaton's question. When you said, how is Donlin Creek going to say we want this money to go here? First off, Donlin Creek can go to any school they want right now and put money into it. That's totally legal. But are they going to be able to get that federal credits that, you know, or not, I shouldn't say credits, but the opportunity to deduct that off their federal taxes? This, again, by allowing that gift request and contributions to be accepted by the state, that can happen. Again, how do we direct those funds in here? Excellent question. We have different areas of the state that already have programs up and running. Representative Fairclough mentioned Job Corps in Anchorage, or our King Career Center in Anchorage. Matsu has Job Corps. Fairbanks has some programs going on. Seward, or Kenai's got programs. Seward. That's one thing that I didn't want to let politics play a role in. In allowing the commissioners of labor and the commissioner of revenue to set up that structure was specifically my intent. Or else you're going to have nothing but a fight, like I think what happened. You're a little bit more, you're just as aware as I am on Senate Bill that maybe happened in 1999 on how the distribution of school funds happened and a little background on that. And I'll just leave it at that. But I want to make sure that we allow the commissioners of labor and the commissioner of education to set up that structuring rate. And I specifically left that out of the hands of the legislature to do that because I didn't want politics playing into that.
I just raised my hand. Representative Newman, is there anything in place, though, that will assure that if a corporation wants it to go to this area because that's where they're going to be working at and that's where they want it, will there be anything that assures that it goes to that area?
Yeah, and thank you, Madam Chair, because it brings me right back into allowing me, and thankfully so, a little bit of leeway on House Bill 61, which allows for a, and that's kind of a cookie that brings companies into this, you could say. And just very briefly, House Bill 61 allows for a 50% corporate tax credit on the first $100,000 investment into a vocational education program, 100% corporate tax credit on a second $100,000 that incentivizes getting to that extra $100,000. Pretty much in a nutshell there, if industry would get a $150,000 corporate tax credit on a $200,000 investment into vocational education. Representative Seaton mentioned our state revenues, our general fund, rightfully so. What does that mean? And then when you look at the corporate taxes that are paid into our state, literally hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, Siri, I believe they testified in a committee at $2.4 million. $150,000 off of their corporate tax bill from our general fund is peanuts. $200,000 into vocational education, that's three or four instructors, that's huge. And so that's kind of the impact on our state, I think, as far as our GF goes. But again, this money for House Bill 2 is all private industry money. If private industry puts money in there, which I feel they will, I know that I've talked to many people from industry. They're very eager to have this bill, and they want to see this and have that opportunity.
Representative Seaton.
I'm just trying to make sure I understand. So then the structure of this bill is Corporation A and Corporation B will donate money to the state of Alaska, which will be directed at vocational education, which the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development and the Commissioner of Education will have a program, a statewide program, and the money will go into that statewide program then to help fund workforce development or vocational education. And it's not really specific to ConocoPhillips wanting to have welders. This is money that's donated in, and then the Commissioner of Revenue and or Commissioner of Education and Commissioner of Labor decide on the program that's going to be funded or funds a percentage of a generalized program that they've developed. And I'm trying to get my handle on the structure of it.
I understand.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Representative Seaton, and it kind of the same question asked another way.
Yeah.
And again, whether the Department of Education or Department of Labor, you know, working together, and by the way, that's the first time that it's been required in statute that two departments work together. And I think the Department of Labor needs to start working with Department of Education on our labor and workforce. This requires in statute that they start doing that. They start working together on these programs. If they want to set up some type of a, you know, I thought about this very hard. And you know, we mentioned how some schools already have some programs, but there's schools that don't have anything. Maybe they would be valued a little bit higher or through a point system or through a grant system. How those sideboards are set up, I'm not sure. I'm just not an expert on how that should be done. And I really don't want to tie the department's hands in that. But I would suspect that they would have some type of a rating system because the schools, all 53 school districts would identify the needs within their each individual schools. The Department of Education would be looking at that. Department of Labor would be looking at that to see where it's needed most. You know, in Mansu we have a potentially a new prison site coming up with 600 jobs. You know, maybe that would signal Department of Labor working with DED to say, okay, we need to get something going in this area a little bit extra, you know, to help those people in that community. Or maybe a resource development program on the Aleutian Change is going on, you know, and they're going to need workers there, welders or mechanics, or whatever the case may be, you know, in that area of the state. So maybe they need to ramp it up there a little bit there. And again, that's how I think that that program should work. They should have that flexibility to define where those needs happen as the state is growing.
Representative Roses?
Thank you, Representative Newman. I appreciate the presentation and certainly like the concept, but I, like a couple of other folks have already mentioned, have a little bit of concern with the application process of it. And so what I see is doing is setting up an account and putting money into a program. We don't know how it's going to be implemented. And more often than not, I think if it's left to that kind of a situation, you're probably going to see it set up as a grant structure. If it's set up as a grant structure, those that have money to leverage matching grants have a tendency to get more money than those that don't have money to start with. Because we as legislators take a look at that and say, hey, we can invest $100,000 in this and we generate $200,000 as a result. So we're able to spread the money around, more of it as a result. And so what I don't want to see happen as a result of this is to provide a better opportunity for those that can maybe take care of themselves now and leave those out that have no ability to take care of themselves, because the entities that we have, and I've seen us do it and talk about it as we looked at some of the budget issues, those that have money and are capable of new matching, we very rarely cut the matching things because we see it as losing twice as much as if we don't do it. So the unintended consequence of that is not funding those that have nothing. And that's my fear. I love the idea. It sort of feels to me like we're putting the funding in place before we know what we're funding. And so I think that's sort of where I hear some of the other comments going, is you can't direct it to an individual project. It sort of just goes into a general pool. And the unfortunate part is it's these three individuals that are going to be determining how that pool of money is going to be distributed. And it seems almost like too distant of a arm length transactions to make some of us a little comfortable. So I'm not opposed to this yet, but I'm also not totally, I love the idea, just not comfortable with how we're going to apply it. And, you know, it is going to move somewhere else besides here, so there's plenty of chances to talk about it. But that's my feeling at this point.
Madam Chair?
Just one second. I let the record show that Representative Sisna has joined us. And sorry, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And certainly not a question that I have not had to face, not have spent many, many hours myself thinking about. And, you know, I think maybe, the best answer that I can say is to allow the experts in the Department of Labor and Department of Education, give them the chance to look at these regulations, to set up the regulations that help structure this. They know a whole lot more about it than I do, you know, as far as how that type of system goes. Maybe my staff can add something to
follow
their,
up.
Follow up.
Just through a different
Representative Roses.
Is there language in here then that allows them to set that criteria up, but yet that they would then come back to us for approval of the program they have established?
Not at this time, Madam Chair. Representative Rose, not at this time. Madam Chair, maybe my staff can throw something in here.
Madam Chair, point of order.
Okay.
We've been listening to a sponsor statement for 35 minutes, and I just want to make sure that we don't have the public waiting, that if we wanted to get into debate and talking about the bill, would it be appropriate to take the rest of the public hearing so we know? Or, and if I'm wrong, I'm
we
fine.
Do have one person online that would like to speak, and so that might be a good idea. So we'll just take there's no one that signed up here and in the room, but we did have
Madam Chair, I believe there's one person in the room.
I didn't get signed up. Before.
Okay, why don't you take it over to them? We'll do that, and then we can move back in and finish, you know. Bob Poe, are you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Bob, why don't you go ahead and state your affiliation and then give us your feelings on this bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Poe. I'm president of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. And I wanted to speak in support of HB 2 and also to encourage the Alaska legislature to go a little bit further. We agree with Representative Newman's comments. This is a step in the right direction to provide funding for vocational education, and many of the things that he's brought up are very true. The way that AEDC got involved in this is we began to think, you know, it's one thing to say that we want a pipeline to bring Alaska's gas to market, and we want to build on Alaska's terms, and we want jobs for Alaskans. It's really quite another to put qualified Alaskans in those jobs. And by the way, the folks that would be building that pipeline are in about sixth grade right now. But we became concerned about the impact of the pipeline would have on our diversified economy. Anchorage is now in its 18th year of uninterrupted job growth, and I understand that Fairbanks can make the same claim. So that really signals that we have a much more diversified economy today. But one of the things about our economy is it's disproportionately baby boomers. Just look around you. And those folks are getting ready to retire. And so what we're finding is that employers are having a very hard time finding the employees they need right now. And so when we think about this, the lack of employees, and this is the first thing that companies ask me when they look at Anchorage and developing a business opportunity in Anchorage, is can they get the employees that they're going to need? So we held a conference on October 9th last year. We didn't purport to be experts on workforce development by any means, but we pulled together all the experts we could find, the university, the labor unions, the different industry groups that have been working on workforce development idea, and brought them together to say, all right, what are the four or five or six things that the legislature, the new administration, the state of Alaska could do to really address this workforce development challenge? And they arrived at six main elements that they believe would be a cohesive workforce development program. And of those, we took a vote of the 100 people that were at this conference. And if it didn't get a 75% approval, we didn't put it forward as an action statement. And there's a document that has gone out called Workforce Development Conference Report that I think many of you may have received. And the four that were voted on at a 75% level, I think are worth pointing out here, because I think that HB 2 takes a step in the right direction, so does the other bill that was mentioned in the discussion, but it only goes just a part of the way to where you need to go, and I think that many of the things that need to happen don't really require new funding sources, but I would encourage you to think about funding sources, because this is about investing in future revenues. The more business we develop, the more revenues the state will have. But the four items were, first, establish a career and technical education outreach program where employers partner with the state of Alaska, the University of Alaska, local schools, and tribal partners to assist students P through 16, parents, out-of-school youth, you know, that's the workforce for gangs, and employed, unemployed Alaskans to learn about training, internship, apprenticeships, and employment opportunities, and provide a tax credit to encourage employers where possible. So Representative Newman's bill certainly does that last item, but there are so many other groups that are working on workforce development, and one of the things that could happen at the state level, whether it's the Department of Labor, the Department of Education, or some sub-cabinet that might focus on this, is to establish a cohesive program. Second, the Department of Labor has a system right now called Alexis, and that basically functions to appropriately market internet-based training and employment clearing center to help students and unemployed Alaskans find training and employment opportunities, and employees find qualified employers find qualified employees and candidates for training programs. We have a survey going on right now where we're asking out-of-school youth primarily, do you know where to get training? Do you know where to get vocational education? And there are all sorts of intern programs that are having a very hard time finding qualified people for their intern programs. Representative Newman made the point about mathematics being a critical element. You can't even be in a union apprenticeship program unless you can pass the math test and you have at least a GED. So we felt that the Department of Labor already has a system that could work as an internet-based clearinghouse to connect potential trainees with training programs, trained potential employees to employers, and employers with training programs to potential trainees. The next is establish in collaboration with private sector employers a clearly articulated career and technical education program that is funded over the long haul. Representative Newman's bill does that because this would be a perpetuating fund. It utilizes existing education facilities more fully, including evenings, weekends, and summers. Think about it. We have schools all over the place, and we don't use those on the weekends. We don't use them in the summer. We don't use them at night, and they could be much more fully utilized. Uses a broad range of educational resources, not limited just to the University of Alaska. There are a lot of ways to learn. Includes a broad range of options, including apprenticeships, internships, private career and technical education programs. Specifically targets rural Alaskans and out-of-school youth, and uses distance learning capabilities where available. So establish a career and technical education program. If we're serious about our future of our economy, we've got to train Alaskans. And lastly, the governor and the legislature should restructure the Alaska Workforce Investment Board by establishing a direct reporting relationship to the governor, making it industry-driven, and establishing full-time professional staff to support the board. That organization right now is buried deep in the Department of Labor, and basically the consensus was either make it a functional organization that really brings this issue to the important level it should be, or do away with the Workforce Investment Board. So I would just say that, and I'm happy to answer what the two that failed were, but those are the elements to a workforce development program that labor, universities, associate general contractors, all sorts of groups felt would be a cohesive program. And I would emphasize that by, as a legislature, investing in such a program, through legislative direction.
Bob?
Yeah, I'm just going to finish real fast. Is an investment in future revenues. I'm done.
Thank you very much. And if anybody else is going to testify, we really need to stick to the bill. And we'll go from there. Mr. Lamont, or Lamont Albertson, would you like to come forward?
Thank you. Sure. I'm really disappointed now that you're going to make us stick to the bill. I had some other things I want to discuss here. But anyhow, my name is Lamont Albertson. I've lived in Aniak and Bethel for the last 40 years. I started teaching school in Aniak in 1967. I served as a principal, associate superintendent, was in charge of the community college in Bethel, and now I'm back in Bethel trying to build a workforce development vocational education institution out there, which we've already got about four-fifths of the money we need, and I'm down here begging for the final money that we need from the legislature. We've got a chance to match up $3,000, $3 million with $1 million if we can get $1 million out of state, and that's all I'm going to say. That has nothing to do with the bill. But I think this is an outstanding bill. I like it because I'm a rural educator. I've seen what our school districts have done out there in terms of eliminating our vocational education classes. They always seem to be eliminated right off the bat. But then what sorts of jobs are available in our local communities? There are jobs where you need the sort of vocational skills that should be taught in our high schools. When I was going to high school, and I bet when many of you were going to high school, you could take an algebra class one period, and the next period you probably could go take a woodworking class or a welding class or something like that. And so you've got a variety of skills as you are getting your high school education. That's not happening in rural Alaska right now. We are sorely failing our young people when it comes to vocational education training. And I believe that this bill will go a long ways. I've met with the people up at Donlin Creek. I know for a fact that in the communities that they're impacting most directly, that they would be willing to support the schools in any way that they could. I think that tax incentive would be something which would encourage them to do that sort of thing. And I think Representative Newman said everything that I would have said earlier, but I'd be delighted to answer any of your questions if you have questions for me.
Representative Seaton?
I just have one. I guess I'm still trying to get a handle on things. So do you see this bill as doing a generalized program across the state? Every school will have one shop in it, or do you see this as a bill that would have, specifically in your area, Donlin Creek, if they deposited money into this fund, you would think that they, that you would be having local, a local program there for Donlin Creek?
As a rural resident for the 40 years I've been up here, I really appreciate where that question's coming from, because I see a lot of things happening in Anchorage that are for rural people, which rural people never get to take advantage of. And so I really appreciate the spirit of that question. But I've also worked for a lot of different commissioners of education in my 26, 27 years as an educator up here. And I believe that the political process is such that if Donlin Creek went to the commissioner of education and went to the commissioner of labor, that they would be allowed to have the teachers in the schools that they want there. You know, you're a professional legislator yourself, you might have a better answer to that question. But from what I've seen is from an educator's point of view, I believe that the political process would allow those instructors to get where they're needed.
Follow-up, Representative.
And just to follow up, I mean, the question is, aren't they needed all the way across the state? I mean, is it, I mean, we have a generalized fund here to support vocational education, and I'm trying to understand there's two different conversations here. One is specific programs, and yet, and the other is that we're going to do a statewide general initiative on vocational education. And I don't see anything in the bill that tells me which direction that's going to go. And if you have any insight into that, to where it's coming from in the bill, I mean, I know everybody has a different idea, but I'm just trying to figure out if I'm misunderstanding
something. Well, again, you know, I believe the political process will sort some of that out. However, we need those programs in all schools, but the state does not seem to address that. You're absolutely correct. It should be from one corner of Alaska to the other. We have the basic vocational education offerings in our schools, but it's not happening. But I know, as a rural resident, I've raised six kids out there. I've got seven grandchildren. Our children do not go far from home and get their training. And the kids who are trained closer to Donlin Creek, the residents in that area, are much more apt to get jobs there than somebody who's going to have to come all the way across the state to sort of get that training. Again, I appreciate where you're coming from. There's all sorts of interest in this state who would like to take what we're trying to do in Bethel and transfer it to Seward or some other place in the state to train all of our kids outside of the region. But we know for a fact that our kids do not do as well the further away from home they are, the more problems they seem to have staying in school. So.
Right. Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else online or here in the room that would like to testify? Okay, then I'm going to close testimony, and we will. I do have a question for Mark. Representative Newman, why don't you come forward? I somehow feel that probably we need some work on the bill as far as, if there is an industry that wants to do it, we all know the political process. And, you know, I think there should be something that in the bill or in some way, shape, or form that would you know, that they should be able to just donate to the school. And maybe not, I don't know how to do it, but I think maybe you need to do some more work on your bill. Now, what do the rest of the committee think? Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Gardner.
Well, I think my question somewhat parallels the chair's question, and that is the bill basically gives a very generous 75% tax credit.
Not this one.
$200,000?
No, that's a different bill.
Okay. Then I don't have a question.
Okay.
Yes, right.
Representative Newman. Gotcha.
Madam Chair, and again, you know, it was suggested by Mr. Poe, and I attended that workforce development program in Anchorage last fall, and was a large part of those discussions, and a lot of the ideas that are in this bill right now came from that. But it's just, as Mr. Poe suggested, you know, maybe we need a workforce development board that helps decide, you know, how things get distributed like this. And look at the problems that we've got with cost differentials, for crying out loud, or lack of discussions. And it's nothing but a political fight, a political process like that. By allowing the commissioners of Labor and Workforce Development and the commissioner of Education to come up and develop a plan like of how this should be structured through regulation instead of statute. You know, changing statute is very difficult. But I think that we can give legislative intent, and if any of the legislators here would like to imply legislative intent on what they would like to see set up in a structure system, I more than welcome that. But looking at just what we have to go through with the cost differential studies in this state, I think if we try and put something in here to tell the experts on labor and workforce development, the experts on education, on how this gets done, I think that we're wrong there. And that's why I specifically did not do that. I did talk with Mr. Luther from the Department of Education. He said he'd come up tomorrow and we could work on some type of ideas for structuring programs, you know, take her down to the next committee. But, you know, I think, you know, if you'd like to imply any intent that you'd like to see happen in this, that's fabulous. I'm more than welcome that. But
okay. Representative,
let's cross this out of it. Education funding is too important.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did not hear all the comments that the committee had made, but we did hear the bill in Ways and Means. And
This is a different bill.
It's not the same one.
No.
Okay, then, pardon, I just erased that. back in your computer there. Then to speak to the comments that I heard on having money go to schools and not having enough sidebars on exactly how that money was spent. And I'm correct there, right? You guys are supposed to be proofreading here. One of the things that I have noticed in my short four decades here is that there is a real flaw in terms of what leaves the state and what happens on the other end in communities throughout the state. And that we really need creative thought here in this body before it gets to the administration. And be pretty careful how we word it. And it is extremely complicated, but that's why we're paid the big bucks, is to make sure that we actually do the creative work. And as was said, it's absolutely essential that we make positive that the programs that are made available to the students of the state are done so in a really fair way, and that that if money is made available to those schools, that we really try to level the playing field for all of our schools. And the ones that probably are the ones that need it the most are the ones that can't afford it, and that really need every incentive possible. Make sure that money has an opportunity to get to them, that there's no disincentive for that money to get there. And so of all the people I know, it seems to me that you, Representative, have been one of those people really eager to step up to the plate and to look at innovative things. So I would encourage you and hope you'll say that you're really ready to look at ways that we can kind of help answer some of the representatives' concerns.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're spinning around something that is two different things, because we've entered a conversation with a previous bill that would allow some credits, and not just state, on creating a line item account. And so I would point out that Representative Newman is not establishing what you're asking him for. You're asking him to establish public funds and the way to move those out of trust accounts. And that's what's been done in all areas of the code. Representative Newman, with the help of our legal counsel, is proposing today a vocational education account, which is a line item, Let me speak about another line item in our code, the Rail Belt Energy Fund. All of us know how complicated that particular fund is. It is one paragraph under 3705.520 that is exactly what Representative Newman's law presents, or his change to the code, or change to statute. In item C, line 12, money, and this is identical to the Rail Belt Energy Fund, which is just a line item account in the general fund, and it says money in the account that is proposed by Representative Newman may be appropriated by the legislature to the state or political subdivision, including regional, and he does present the thought of how he would like to see the fund used. But in essence, in the Rail Belt Energy Fund, we say the Department of Revenue is going to establish the disbursement of those funds through establishment of regulations, which we do not approve. We are sent out through the public process, notification of regulations or regs coming up, and through the public process, we comment on that. And so if you go to page 2, it says that Representative Newman is proposing to make the people in charge of developing the regulations for this is going to be the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development in consultation with the Commissioner of Education. So he's not creating the framework today. All he's doing is getting a line item in there, so if there is someone in the public who, which is a perfect opportunity right now. We have gas line conversations going. We have vocational ed coming to the front of the discussions. And so I would encourage us to not try to invent a will here, but move this forward to finance, because it is one line in the GF that we have total control on. The legislature may appropriate. He is not designating any funds. He is creating a depository if someone would like to donate to us. And those commissioners will decide what is best for all of Alaskans. And through the appropriation and budget process, that's when we have our second swipe at it to say we're not going to let you contribute from that fund, or we are. But I think that we're trying to overthink this particular piece of legislation. It is creating one line on the GF fund. It does not require the expertise from my reading of what we're doing in here. And those other sources are more dedicated funding. So I would make a motion to move this bill from committee, HB225-LS0006/C, with appropriate fiscal note and as amended or individual recommendations. This
object.
Okay, Representative Sisson.
Thank you. Because I would like to, and I understand that it's a simple line in the budget, but that simple line in the budget is just one more line that could have attached to it something that we haven't dealt with yet in schools. And if no one else on this committee agrees with my hesitation before fully developing this, I will remove my objection.
Madam Chair, any comment?
Just a second. I have the only reservation I have is that this is going to be what's going to happen. Business, once they if this is going to be divided equally among across the state, if this particular thing
we
is
don't know.
You know, yeah, I mean, we don't know, but I would imagine if that is indeed what happens, then I would say probably business isn't going to do any, because they want it to go to where they want it to go. And if it doesn't go where they want it to go, then they won't be doing it.
Madam
but,
Chair.
You know.
Madam Chair, if I may comment on some of the discussion.
Shortly, yeah.
Exactly right is what Representative Fairclough said. This is just creates a depository for private industry to put their money into vocational education. That's simply all it does. But before we can distribute it, we have to get the money there.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a line item to create a fund to deposit. If no one is interested, no money will go into it. But what is happening is it provides an opportunity for someone like ConocoPhillips, or as you heard, Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, say they may have partners. And while Representative Newman and those who testified are saying they'd like a broad picture and all of Alaska to be a beneficiary of this particular fund, that's not the intent today. The intent is to have a repository for funds to come into and an opportunity for individual communities, let's say Sitka or somewhere in Southeast where you have a partner in a fishing corporation who would like to deposit, and you develop a memorandum of understanding that will allow, hopefully, at some point in time, a federal deduction and a business state partnership to develop economically some trade in that particular area. It is not, I don't mean anything disrespectful. Representative Newman is thinking idealistically in what he wants a vocational program to look at. He is interested in all children, from my perspective, throughout the state, but that's not what this is. It's a line item so that people can start to look at, even if it's from a very small acorn of just a little bit of dollars going in, that you can develop partnerships, and with your approval, and we still have our approval before it can go anywhere. So I understand that we want the larger program, but we're opening a checking account and allowing private sector to deposit into it. If I were queen of the world in this department, then I would go out for grants. And if I went out for grants, then I would develop the regulations that showed you exactly what you're looking for, and that is statewide vocational ed support. But if I don't have the line item, there's no reason for me to invest in developing the process, because those are all very specific to what a particular grant might want and expect us to do with that. There'll be specific regulations inside of those grants. And so if I have understood correctly, this is one line. It's very simple. It goes on to finance. They will have a deeper discussion on whether there needs to be broader regulations to develop the one line. But Representative Newman, you have my support, obviously, in moving it forward.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think there was some confusion because we got into specifics of what a program would look like, but we don't specify a program. And I do agree that what we're talking about is establishing a fund, just like we had a capital income fund or other funds, and then the legislature has to appropriate out of that. And we're not going to appropriate out of it until we see a program that we agree with. So, I'm sorry for the confusion that I added to when I was asking the questions based on the philosophy that it was being presented, because I think this establishing of a fund is all this does, and I think that that could promote vocational education, so I'll support that.
And I agree. It probably, this fund probably wouldn't have any trouble getting funds donated to it, because if we were going to do anything, we know where the votes are. And so the other fund doesn't get funded like it should because the votes aren't there. So this would just be setting it up so the we know where the money would probably go. Okay. So what's the will of the committee? And we still have an objection. Are you?
Madam Chair, I will remove my objection with a comment.
Okay.
And that comment is, thank you. That comment is that that one of the real tragedies in Alaska, as it was mentioned, I believe, by Mr. Poe, is that throughout Alaska, in the smallest communities that I've visited, in the schools, interestingly enough, in the schools, they're essentially buildings that are almost like, they're almost like museums of all the different phases of technology and interesting things that were never really, or a lot of them not fully developed, but they wound up in those schools. And there's really no place to put them in the neighborhood, in the community. There's no, you can throw them away, but where? And that those small communities wind up receiving millions of dollars oftentimes in those things that never were really, they were never thought through. Nobody ever figured out how to integrate them into our educational program and to have those things actually bring about jobs for that community, sustainable economic development, any of that. And this will be yet another possible continuation of that without there ever being any way to integrate and really develop sources of revenue to build jobs in small places. And we could do it. this bill doesn't really address that. It's just another way to have people have a place to put their money. And I just think it's sad. It's sad that we all have to maybe put legislation in that may or may not get anywhere. And I think it could have done more. I remove my objection. Thank you.
Okay. Do I hear a motion?
I made the motion.
She already made the motion.
Oh, okay. Then.
And she objected. She withdrew her objection.
All right. The no objection, so the motion carries. We just set up a bill for the Braille bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
No, I'll talk about it later.
All right, Representative Guerra, why don't you come forward, and we will hear now House Bill 140.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'll bring up my aide, Megan Foster, who's helped me with this bill, and who can help me when I get it wrong. And I'm going to try and save time by only talking about this bill and none of my other bills.
Thank you.
I object.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 140 tries to achieve a goal that many of us have talked about, and that is to make sure that every child in the state has available health insurance. Sometimes we have debates as to what we should do about adult health care. Sometimes we have debates about what we should do for people who don't work for a living. But what this bill is about is providing health care to children whose parents work but who don't have health insurance. And I think I've spoken to a number of the members of the legislature, Republicans, Democrats, and the concept that we should make sure that there's available health coverage for kids of parents who work who don't have health insurance right now, I think seems to be something where we can meet a common ground. Right now in Alaska, if you don't work or if you work and you earn less than 155% of the poverty level, you have health insurance available to your children, and if you're pregnant, you have health insurance available to you. House Bill 140 expands that. It does what right now I think six other states have done in some form or another. It says under the federal CHIP program, it's the Federal Children's Health Care Program, that we should make health coverage for all children and pregnant women available to them in families that earn up to 200% of the poverty level. That's the level that 40 states are at. They're at that level or above. Only two states in the country right now provide health coverage to a smaller pool of people than Alaska does. That is, only two states allow health coverage for incomes at a lower level than we allow health coverage for under our Denali Kid Care program. We believe you can extend health care in a way that's efficient, inexpensive, and moral. And we think that House Bill 140 does all of those things. One of the great things it does is it leverages a huge amount of federal funding. That's why the fiscal note is a lot smaller than many of us thought it would be, somewhere around $6 million to extend the available health coverage to what we believe would be every child in the state. Just a couple of facts. Right now, if we don't change our Denali Kid Care program, our health care program for kids, we're actually going to lose all federal eligibility maybe within a year or 2 years. If you provide health coverage to only families earning less than 150% of the poverty level, I think that's right, and there will be people in the audience who can correct me, but once you fall below a certain level, the federal government just withdraws their matching contribution. At least under the CHIP program, they might allow Medicaid funding, but they withdraw their CHIP program funding, I believe. And every year, the way Alaska's current program works, we insure people only at a lower poverty level every single year. In most states, children are insured if they're in families that earn 200% of the poverty level or less. We insure people in families that earn a certain income. And as the poverty level goes up and up with inflation, we're insuring people at a lower and lower poverty level. In 2003, we intended to insure families at 175% of the poverty level or below, but we did it at a firm dollar amount, and because of that, right now we're insuring families only at 156% of the poverty level or below, and that number is going to keep going down. Denali Kid Care provides full health coverage to kids, so doctor's visits, dental visits, eye exams, things like that, and it provides full health coverage to women for pregnancy-related medical visits and all the way through term. Since 2003, when we adjusted our formula, roughly 3,500 kids have fallen from the Denali Kid Care rolls. We believe in the next year up to 500 or even 1,000 kids will fall from the rolls again, just because of the way we've set our eligibility level. In terms of what this will cost and what this will save, right now hospitals just in Anchorage pay about $90 million out of their own pockets to cover patients who are uninsured. And what they do is very likely transfer some or all of those costs onto other patients. So that $90 million isn't free. By not insuring Alaskans, we cause hospitals to bear a burden that they probably pass along to consumers, at least to a great extent. In Alaska, roughly 18,000 kids don't have health insurance. Half of those people, from the information we have from one study, are kids who are in families that earn 200% of the poverty level and below. And the other half are working families that earn above 200% of the poverty level. We know that uninsured children are much less likely to get medical treatment than children and families that do have insurance. The stats that we've seen are that one-third of uninsured kids don't go in on an annual basis to get any medical treatment. Nationwide, 80% of the uninsured children in this country are from working families. There has been in this state a 30% decline in the number of kids who have had insurance over the last 10 years, just over the last 10 years for a variety of factors. If you're uninsured, you're four times as likely to go to the emergency room for care than you are to a much cheaper visit at the doctor's office. The way we have set up this bill is as follows. I'm going to try and rush this because I know there are folks in the room or maybe online who would like to testify, and I can certainly take questions. The way we have it set up is this. Up to 200% of the poverty level, we do what 41 other states do, 40 or 41 other states do, which is we provide free medical care to kids. That is roughly 70% paid for by federal funds, as long as you have a qualifying plan, and we do. Above the 200% poverty level, we do what roughly six states are doing now. Connecticut, North Carolina, Florida, Maine, New Hampshire, New York, in various ways. We say families can buy in. They can buy into Denali Kid Care insurance for a sliding scale fee somewhere between $200 and close to $2,000, depending on how high the family's income is. We'll charge you a sliding scale fee. The state pays, on average, roughly about $1,000 per child per year in out-of-pocket to cover kids' medical care through the Denali Kid Care program. So for the lower income people above the 200% poverty level, the state will lose money. For the higher income folks, the state will have some excess money. There will be administrative costs for this program, but we think that's a fair way to do it. We have, and the committee might take a look at this, we also have a copay. If you're above 250% of the poverty level, we've said there should be a 20% copay. I've had second thoughts about that because the administrative cost of enforcing a copay might be as much as the benefit the state gets by charging the copay. So as a matter of responsibility, we might want to have a 20% copay. On the other hand, I'm not so sure that that provision makes all the sense in the world, and that's certainly one of the things the committee might take a look at, deleting that sentence or leaving it in. And what we do for pregnant women is, with children, you can plan in advance and say, I want my children to have health coverage, I'm going to buy in. Obviously, if you're pregnant, you're not going to buy insurance a year in advance to cover your pregnancy, probably not. So what we've done for pregnant women coverage under the Medicaid program is provided free coverage up to 200% of the poverty level, but we don't extend the buy-in provision to pregnant women. It just didn't seem administratively like that could work, but that's certainly something the committee can consider. But it's the most efficient way we think we can come up with to extend available medical coverage to every child in the state. We extend the buy-in up to families up to 300% of the poverty level. We figure above that, families probably don't need the help. In New Hampshire, they do it to up to 400% of the poverty level. I think in Connecticut, they have no limit. I think their point is if you want to buy in, you can buy in. We'll just charge you the full cost. And the way this is funded is if you have a plan that is qualified by the federal government And we make the bill, we've written the bill in a way where it takes effect upon approval by the federal government, and so that we get an approved SCHIP plan through the federal government. If you get federal approval under the current formula, the feds are going to pay roughly 70% of the cost. If you don't get federal approval, and the department can explain this if you'd like, then you fall under the sort of Medicaid match, which is right now Medicaid pays 57% of your medical care costs in this state. I think the fear is that's probably going to go down closer to 50% this coming year. And then the SCHIP program, the federal program that covers, that extends health care to children that Denali KidCare is under, that this would be under, that the other states' programs are under, it's up for reauthorization this year. So so it's another reason to make this contingent on federal approval of the plan. And then what we do on the rates, the amount that you charge to families, we give the department some flexibility in what they're going to charge. We've said you can charge up to, and the reason we say up to is if you charge too much under, if you charge a family too much, the federal government will not grant you approval of your plan. And so we want to leave to the department the flexibility to change the rates and the eligibility levels a little bit just to make sure they get federal approval. So we have the suggested amounts, but we call that, that's sort of like an up to level, and the department can adjust it in order to make sure they get federal approval for the plan. This started over a conversation a few of us had this summer. We were trying to think of a way to come up with a universal health coverage plan that wouldn't have a sticker shock problem. I think we've achieved that. $6 million is less than 0.5% of this year's surplus. $6 million is less than, it's roughly 5% of the cost hospitals pay just for treating uninsured people. I believe, but I don't have a study in my hand, that this program will save more than that money in terms of long-term medical costs that you will suffer when you let your kids just get treated in the emergency room. I think it'll save families money, the money families have to pay because they let their kids get too sick before seeking medical care and they have to miss work. There are, I think, 100 reasons why prevention up front saves you money over the long term. And for this amount of money, I think it's a very wise thing to do. And with that, I'll just let the committee proceed the way the chair wants the hearing to proceed.
I will have a few questions, but we have a lot of people that would like to testify. So we'll just go briefly around and answer the immediate questions. Representative Roses.
Yes, I'd like to focus in the beginning on page 3, starting at about line 28.
Madam Chair, is that the committee substitute that we provided?
Let me make sure that it is. I think it is. Yes, it's committee substitute version K. Part of it is to where you've changed the language, and it says federal poverty guidelines for Alaska set by the United States Department of Health and Human Services, and you've taken out official poverty line. Does this then mean that your 250% multiplier doesn't go to the federal poverty level, but it goes to the 135% multiplier that the state of Alaska uses? So in essence, this becomes 337.5% of the federal poverty level?
Well, there's a through the chair, Representative Roses, there's a federal poverty level that's established for the people in this state, and it'll be up that percentage that we have in this bill multiplied by the Alaska poverty level. So the Alaska poverty level is roughly 30%, 20% higher than the federal poverty level, given the cost of living here, especially in the rural areas.
Okay, so I'm not so much looking at the number as I am the wording. So adding the federal poverty guidelines for Alaska as opposed to the official poverty line then goes to that 135%, and then on top of that 250%. So we're no longer talking about 250% of the federal level. We're talking about 250% of the Alaska level, which equals 337.5% of the federal level. So that's substantially different than 250%.
Through the chair, Representative Roses, when I said the poverty level, I meant the Alaska level that's set by the department, and that is higher than the level outside.
Thanks. And that would apply throughout the rest of the pages where there's a multiplier.
Any other questions? Then Representative Newman.
Madam Chair, I don't have a version A, but
it's version K.
Okay. I do have a version K. Scrambling here. We're looking for version A. On page 6, line 22,
well, actually paragraph D, it talks about a 20% copay. Is there a limit or a maximum or minimum requirement that you have to meet, $500 deductible, $1,000? It's just 20% straight across the board.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Newman, we haven't put in a deductible in this bill. And at that level of income, that only applies to people who earn 250% of the poverty level in Alaska or more. At that point, we believe families are actually paying more than the state's cost for participating. And so I wouldn't see any need for a deductible.
One more question.
Follow-up, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Guerra, again on page 6, line 3, starts out whose household income. How is household income verified?
The federal government has a schedule, and we've provided it inside the chart, but inside the packet. We haven't numbered the pages, so it would take me some time to find. But there, you'll see a table, and they define it. It's a different income level depending on the size of your family. The bigger your family, the higher the poverty level line is. For example, for a family of two, the poverty level in Alaska is roughly $17,000. For a family of three, I think it's roughly $20,000. I think there's about a $3,000 difference for the extra child. And so there's a table. It goes all the way up to, I'm not sure how many children in a family.
I think it's on page 3147, I think.
Yep.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Newman.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garrett, I realize that there's scales like that. But again, is how do you verify that? Because that's the problem where I have people, you approach me constantly. They say, well, you know, gal darn, I'm standing in line. This guy comes up and he's got, gets free food from the state, you know, through different programs. And they're wearing leather jackets and diamond rings. And how do you verify this? I mean, how do you say that this is how we're going to do this and know exactly that you're getting accurate figures? Is there a way to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I wouldn't tell the department how to verify it. How I would verify it is on the application, I would require an under oath statement so that if you lie, you've committed a felony. That's how I would do it. It's the same issue under the current program. It's the same issue under the permanent fund dividend application. It's the same issue under virtually everything you apply to your government for. And I would have... right now on the books, you can have very severe consequences if the department wanted them. They could make it a felony by making you submit your application under oath. There's a crime of unsworn falsification. If they don't want to make you do it under oath, they could make you sign a form that says at the bottom it acknowledges that if you do not tell the truth on the form, you've committed a crime also, even without an oath if you're notified. Those are two ways to do it.
Okay. Representative Roses.
The other part following along, when you get back to some of the other pages, like page 5, page 6, in those areas where you're talking about a multiplier, you again then go back to the federal poverty guideline as opposed to the Alaska guideline. So in one section, you're still talking about the federal, whereas in this section, you're talking about the Alaska. So I think we have some inconsistency in that. But the other part that gives me a little bit of concern is, in the area where you talk about a person can buy into the program for their children, have you done a comparison for not for school districts or public employees where quite often the family is covered under the same plan that the employer is, but go to some of the private companies where they cover the employer only and then they have to pay extra for the family members? Have you compared the cost of what a person is paying to cover their children there as opposed to what would they pay if they had to cover two children here? Because we may be setting ourselves up for a scenario where people that currently have their kids covered, even if they make, regardless of what amount of money they make, we've now set it up for a situation where they're going to cancel their insurance there and come to the one that the state has just simply because they're trying to find a way to save money, not because their kids aren't covered.
Through the chair, Representative Roses, we wanted to make it consistent throughout the bill that it's always the federal poverty guideline for Alaska that we're talking about. If there's a bill drafting problem, that's the intention, and we'll make sure it's corrected. But that was the intention throughout. That's what we'd ask the drafters to do. On the issue of cost in the private sector, we don't know the specific cost of adding a child to an employer plan. But some of the surveys we did found that just a childhood health care policy for just the child by some companies is upwards of $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a year. And that's why you have so many people who make $40,000 a year who don't have health insurance, because the plan costs are prohibitive. And what you get through the benefit of having a Medicaid coverage is you have a larger pool, and with a larger pool you can bring the costs down. And that's one of the problems self-employed people have in getting coverage, is the pools are so small. And then your last question, we're not 100% sure we can do this legally, but to address your last question, we don't want people canceling available work health insurance plans that are available for their kids because this is cheaper. So we have a provision in here that says you have to certify that you don't have a work plan available for your child. Because the intention is, if you have a work plan available, we want you to participate in it. Other states have done that in one form or another. We need to double check whether that's whether the wording is proper under the law that would allow us to get federal approval of our plan. But that's one way to do it. The other way to do it is, frankly, at a certain income level, the state's not losing money by extending coverage. So it probably wouldn't cause me heartache to extend coverage to somebody at cost if they could have had a work plan anyway.
Follow up, Representative Roses.
So did I just hear you say that they wouldn't be eligible if they had a work plan available, or if they had a work plan in force?
Available. If you have a work plan available for your child, the intention of the bill and the wording of the bill is that you participate in that, that you avail yourself of the coverage.
Because there's an awful lot of people that have plans available that can't afford them. And plus, if you look at the poverty guideline amount that you mentioned, if for a family of two, we're at $17,120, and you use a 250% multiplier, doesn't that take that up to $62,800?
For the family of two, $17,000, 200%, $34,000.
$17,120 and 250% of that is what we're talking about?
That would be roughly $40,000.
Yes, it would. 42.8.
Sure. Right. And I think that's why you have so many families uninsured at that income level. You have a family that makes $40,000 a year, and a family health insurance plan is $8,000, $9,000, $10,000. And your family that makes $40,000 a year, 25% of that, let's say, goes to taxes. It's why 50% of the families that are uninsured are above 200% of the poverty level.
But how does that help if there's a program available where they work, but they can't afford to take advantage of it? How does this help if you've exempted those that have a plan available through their work?
Representative Roses,
even if they make $20,000 a year, if it's available and they can't afford it, they still don't qualify according to this.
Only if you're above 200% of the poverty level. So that would be families making roughly $34,000. You could certainly amend it to say, if you have a plan available that would cost less than X for your children, you have to participate in it. That way you wouldn't force somebody to participate in a work plan that maybe costs $10,000 per child. I don't know if there is such a thing, but that would be something that you could do if you wanted to refine it, if you feared that we were forcing families to enroll their children in work plans that were too expensive.
One more, and then we'll go to testimony, because we've got quite a list.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Guerra. Earlier in the year, we heard at a joint session with the Senate, we heard about a very complicated health overhaul in the health program. How is this going to affect that? I mean, obviously, they're going to butt heads there somewhere. They both need federal approval, but how are we meshing together?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, this bill would be contingent on getting the federal approval, which is also going to be contingent on the federal government reauthorizing the program. So if the federal government gets rid of the program, this bill's not going anywhere. If we apply for federal approval and we don't give the department enough flexibility to write the plan and we don't get federal approval, this bill doesn't go anywhere. So we've tried to keep the bill flexible and contingent on the federal approval so that there is no butting of heads.
What I'd like to do now is do testimony, and for all of you that will testify, if there's any way, except for the department, I'll give them a little bit longer, but I'd like to limit it to 2 minutes, and then please don't repeat something that you heard someone else testify, and then we can keep it pretty short, and maybe we'll be able to get everybody in. So first of all, I'm going to go...
Madam Chair?
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you. I just was wondering if there's a possibility to see if someone can't testify at a different time, if we might take those individuals first. I know that we have some in the audience today that are actually traveling.
Yeah, I'm going to ask that.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam. I want to get the ones that are off net first because they're on other telephones. So first of all, Brenda Moore, are you online?
I'm here.
Okay, Brenda, go ahead and state your name and your affiliation and then your testimony.
I'm Brenda Moore, and I am a mental health board member. I also chaired the coalition, the Covering Kids and Families Coalition, which was a Robert Wood Johnson initiative. And I have a couple of statistics. Just yesterday, Robert Wood Johnson released a new report and with statistics, and those statistics came from the current population surveys and the annual social and economic supplement. So I just wanted to give a couple of these statistics that might help add to what Representative Guerra just said. First of all, that the 200% of federal poverty level is a federal definition for low income, and that allows families to be able to take care of their that's what allows families to take care of their basic needs is if they're at 200% that they've said that they're able to take care of rent and transportation and child care and all the other kinds of things that they need. And for a three-year average, the report says that the percentage of uninsured children 0 to 18 who are living in families below 200% of federal poverty level in Alaska is 53.2% or roughly 11,000 children. The number and percent of children without health insurance for a three-year average between 2003 and 2005.
Okay, Brenda, your 2 minutes are up, so can you just quickly sum up?
Is 20,000, is about 2,500. Anyway, what I wanted to say is it's not just the children that are under 200% of federal poverty level who are uninsured and going without insurance. The number is higher than that, and it does cost us in the long run.
Okay, thank you. Next is Dr. Bhutto. Are you online? I probably didn't pronounce.
Yes.
Did I pronounce your name right?
Yes.
Oh, how about that? Okay, great. Would you just tell us your affiliation and your give us your testimony?
My name is Jody Bhutto. I'm a pediatrician in Anchorage. I'm president of the American Academy of Pediatrics Alaska chapter, and we're obviously very much for anything that provides better access to care for children, and this bill would do that. We actually looked at what it costs private families to buy insurance and to buy into their workplace. A lot of the families who are at these levels or lower income levels work at smaller jobs that don't have access to care, so they can't necessarily buy into of their employer's insurance because it's not offered. And by providing the ability to get care, children get preventative care. They get their immunizations, and we are able to find small problems early and treat them and prevent, like they said, emergency room visits, prevent bigger problems. For example, if children have multiple ear infections that go untreated, then they have hearing problems, they have language problems, and it escalates from there. Whereas we get them in, we see them regularly, they have a medical home, we can find these problems early and treat them and avoid the problems altogether.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm going to jump to the room here. Is there anyone here that's got to catch a plane or can't come back at another time in case we don't get to you? Okay, why don't you come on up there?
I just have spring concert for my children. I'm Monica Gross. I'm a pediatrician here in Juneau, and I'm a pediatrician. I've been practicing since 1993. I'm obviously also here in support of House Bill 140. When children have medical insurance, it changes the entire healthcare emphasis in families. Medical care is shifted from crisis-oriented care to well-child preventative care. This shift has ramifications not only for children's health, but also for family health. When families don't have medical insurance, kids are brought to the doctor when they are very sick, and parents are very scared. Doctors respond in an emergency room way. Tests are ordered, drugs prescribed, parents admonished for waiting too long. When kids have medical insurance, they are brought in for well-child checkups and preventative care. The whole medical model shifts. Parents and doctors are a team, and they're working together to keep children healthy and prevent disease. Parents feel empowered, and the work they are doing is validated, being good parents. Time is available to answer questions. This exchange between doctors and families really sets the stage for families where children can grow and develop healthily. Please support House Bill 140.
We have some questions, if you don't mind. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, of course, this comment has come to me from the Kenai Peninsula and mainly from dentists that were doing the same kind of work. And the problem was without a copay that they were experiencing, kids can't, not making their appointments, not calling ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Have you experienced that at all with?
In private practice?
Yes.
I think if you develop a relationship with a family, then they feel a stronger obligation to keep appointments and to be engaged in their health care. So, there certainly is a problem sometimes with families that get free care where they abuse the system. I'm not saying that's not present. But for the families that this bill is oriented towards, I see that as being less of a problem.
And follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
Do you think that a copay if you don't show up to your appointment or something like that, penalty?
I think that's reasonable. I do. I could understand Representative Garris' thoughts that might take a lot of money to, do the paperwork on. It would certainly present more paperwork for the doctor's offices, but I could see how that could cause families to feel more responsible.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
When you experience the people coming in on a routine basis and people coming in an emergency, tell me the difference of maybe an example or two about what's the difference as far as preventative? Is the preventative worth the money that we'd be putting in? What is your opinion?
Absolutely. A very simple example. If you have time to kind of work with families and talk about breastfeeding rather than a mother who's sent home and doesn't feel like she can come in for afford a well-child checkup, she goes home. Breastfeeding's hard in the beginning. It's a lot of work and walking parents through that. If she doesn't have the support, she'll stop breastfeeding. And, it's clear. If mothers don't have support, they stop. If parents are allowed to come in and get their well-child checkup, that's one place that you can really support them, and breastfeeding goes on to improve health in all sorts of different ways. Another example I was thinking is if you don't know a family and a kid comes in and, for example, has a tummy ache, in your mind you don't know this family, you don't know maybe grandma just died of stomach cancer or blah, blah, blah,
your immediate response is to go into more of a emergency room mode where you're ordering more tests and you're doing things that you wouldn't necessarily do if you knew the family and knew the background. So, there's just so many examples where when you're seeing families for regular well-child care, overall, it definitely decreases costs. And, you know, I didn't really even talk about costs because I knew a lot of other people would, but I think the thing I really tried to cover in my talk is just it really empowers families as well, I think. Rather than Johnny's sick, this is a crisis, we've got to go to the doctor, even though it's going to mean that he doesn't get shoes next month, we've got to go, versus, oh, Johnny's 6 months old, it's his well-child check, you come in, you get weighed and measured, you get positive reinforcement, oh, Johnny's gaining grade, oh, look, he's sitting up, isn't that fantastic? And there's a real exchange there. I do a lot of well-child care for legislators and lawyers and doctors in Juneau, and, you know, these are people that have resources available, and everybody likes to hear that their child is growing and developing well, and to ask them questions, and to feel like they have a place where they can be a parent and be validated for being a parent, and well-child care provides that.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for letting me go.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to online. Is there anyone here that feels like that they need to testify before we go back on? Let's try to decide. I guess we'll. Why don't we have the department come up and talk a little bit first? And kind of give us an idea. I'm sure that we're not going to.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Faircloth.
Could we let the public that's listening and those at home know that we will not, we'll be hearing public hearing again on this?
Okay. Yeah, for all of you that are online, this probably is going to take more than 10 minutes, and so, we will continue with this. We will announce it. Yeah, we will announce it because we don't know for sure when we'll get back to it because we've got already other bills, you know, scheduled for next time. So we will definitely schedule it so that you'll know.
Madam Chair, for the record, Carlene Jackson, Commissioner for Health and Social Services. With me, I have Assistant Commissioner Janet Clark for Finance and Management. We also have a couple folks online. We're going to be very brief and mostly just answer questions if you have them. The bottom line for us about this bill is minimally, we want to make sure, as Representative Guerra said, that dollar amount that's frozen in statute, is that freeze is lifted, and we go to a percent of poverty and not that fixed dollar amount. That to us is incredibly important. There are various bills out here around SCHIP in terms of what that percentage number should be. We leave that up to the wisdom of the legislature to decide. We do have several fiscal notes, however, that address the different pieces and parts of how the bill is constructed, and we're happy to answer questions about those.
Representative Roses.
We just heard the previous person testify, the physician, and I appreciate the testimony very much. But there were several references back to well baby. Bring them in for a checkup. And, you know, they're more likely, the more checkups they get, the better they're going to do, the healthier they're going to be. Does this insurance program, because this is what it is, does this insurance program for Denali Kid Care cover just checkups anytime they want? Because I know my health insurance doesn't cover checkups. Me and my kids only get to go to the doctor when we're sick. It doesn't cover wellness, doesn't cover prevention, doesn't cover checkups, doesn't cover blood tests unless it's associated with an illness or a complaint. So this does do that?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, yes, this does do periodic, regular, preventive checkups for children.
And if I remember, when there's a baby delivered, lots of times the doctor will have the follow-up that is included in the delivery fee and stuff like that, you know, sometimes. But that's a family doctor. But if they have to go from the delivery doctor to a pediatrician, then that probably changes. You know, I don't know how that works, but depends on the situation, I'm sure. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, this bill asks for a federal poverty level to rise between 200 and 350%, or a percentage of 200 to 350% above federal poverty.